Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about disrupting spells in D&D. You know, some editions ban it, some roll for initiative, and some have skill checks to cast spells in combat. We're going to figure out what's the best rule here. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we begin the conversation, I will remind everyone at the end of the show, we will be hosting our After Party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host with all our patrons. And you can join in by simply joining our Patreon, patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier and you'll get an invite to our private Discord server. Get your account all set up there. And at the end of the show, maybe about 10 minutes after the hour, we will be there ready to host a live video chat.
We love getting a chance to speak with our patrons every week. For example, our patron Backwius for checking in right now that we are live on YouTube, Twitch, and Restream. Exactly as I started that sentence is exactly when he checked. Could not have the timing any better on that. Our patrons, mwah, just brilliant.
So this is kind of an offshoot of our conversation from last week, right? We were talking about initiative, various initiative systems, and one of like the outcomes, I guess, of how you do initiative is, or one of the things that is impacted by your initiative system is whether or not there's even a window of time in which a spell can be interrupted, right? And when we tried to start discussing that, of course, it blows up, and then we're like, okay, that's a whole other show. Right? So here it is. Here's the other show.
I frankly had notes and I wanted to get that in last week. And we agreed like we're not going to have time for that. Some of our patrons on our Discord server immediately picked up on that and immediately started asking follow-up questions about, well, then if you do this, then how does the disrupting spells work? And there was a really nice conversation this week about that. So I felt like we should join on the train there. And participate ourselves in what we do. And you know, for me, this was just this weekend preparing for this show was a really nice opportunity because I myself learned some facts about the newest editions of D&D that I did not know actually. So, and one of the fascinating things is if you do look at this historically over the years, there's this totally interesting arc in how things have gone from one end of the continuum to the other end of the continuum, basically making things more generous for your wizard type characters, which was, I thought, a very interesting story. And you know, for me, I had a question mark for many years because once again, this is one of the places where if you pick up the little brown books of original D&D, it doesn't say anything about this one way or the other, like just like the initiative system that we were talking about last week. It's not in D&D, partly because it's relying on what came before in the chainmail game, or maybe things that it had to detail later in Swords and Spells or Advanced D&D or something like that. And so the very weird situation of original D&D just not talking about a whole lot of major things once again gives you these gaps that people have filled in all kinds of different directions over the years, which is kind of interesting.
The thing I found really fascinating about this, Dan, is that, you know, our viewers know that you often come from the original D&D or sometimes the AD&D perspective. I'm much more firmly rooted in BX D&D. And generally, I would say a lot of times on this show, you and I laud BX for really clarifying language and making things more clear than the editions that came before it. However, in this case, I will say BX made it more vague. And in fact, I will say BX is in some ways self-contradictory on this issue, which is very interesting. And we'll get into that as we examine the different versions.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I want to dig in. Right before we do that, I don't know if it was like a year ago or a year and a half ago, I went on to the OD&D 74 forums with a lot of aficionados of the original game from 74. And if there's a consensus about these vague issues, I want to know what it is. So I asked a poll, and I have the results of that in the first image there today, Paul. So I asked a poll of top level original D&D players, do you let magic users cast spells in hand-to-hand combat? And it pretty much split all three ways. So there were of this, not huge poll there. There were four people that said, yes, I absolutely let wizards cast a spell in direct hand-to-hand combat, no matter what else is happening. And about a third of the people said, well, maybe depending on some kind of die roll, maybe, I don't know, ability check or initiative or something like that. And then six people said, no, absolutely never. Wizards cannot cast spells no matter what is happening. Utterly, totally prohibited. So one of the more unusual cases where it basically all over the board how people interpret the original D&D, not too surprising because it's frankly not in the books.
I think this is a case, Dan, where kind of the devil is in the details. And I'm curious what, if any, clarifications or whatnot you added to the answer here. I mean, it's fascinating, first of all, to me that you even phrased it this way, because I was prepared for, like, what initiative system do you use and where are the windows for spell interruption? But, like, let's step it way back to just, can wizards even cast spells at all in combat? But that is or maybe is not what you're asking here, because you specify hand-to-hand combat. So are you imagining, do you allow them when they are directly engaged with an enemy? Or do you allow them when they are in a combat scene, but maybe not directly in hand-to-hand? Which one are we talking about?
It's so great that you are picking on that, Paul. Because, so what I wasn't going to say here today is that this is, what you're actually looking at is the second time that I attempted to more clearly phrase the question. Because the first time, I phrased this, do you let magic users cast spells in melee? And the conversation went just bonkers in every different direction, exactly based on the difference, the wild difference of interpretations that you're kind of picking on. So in the text, when I asked the question, I tried really, really hard to make it. Here's a very specific. So there is a wizard and they are standing 5 feet away from an opponent fighter. The fighter is active. The fighter is aware. The fighter is armed. The fighter is looking to do damage to the wizard as soon as possible and as violently as possible in any way they can. Can the wizard cast an offensive spell such as charm person or suggestion or hold person or something like that? While they're being confronted by the armed, opposed, aware, alert fighter, I tried to make it very, very clear because
that's much more specific than this one sentence that we're looking at on the screen right now, which just says, "Do you let magic users cast spells in hand-to-hand combat?" And the funny thing is, like, I think it's clear. I think that question is clear to me that you're talking about, yes, the exact scenario you just talked about. But I could see how readers of a poll might just kind of glaze over the hand-to-hand part and just be like, oh, combat in general? Absolutely, no problem. And then realize, like, oh, no, you meant, like, somebody swinging a sword at them? Okay, then maybe not.
And in particular, the thing that gets tangled up in these conversations is use of the word melee. And I think that because, like, if you look at chainmail or like the earliest editions, right, you've got a phase for missile combat and you've got a separate phase for melee combat. And so melee combat is clearly hand to hand, your figures are touching, that hitting with a sword. And then like around first edition, they started to use this phrase melee rounds for any kind of missile spells, hand-to-hand combat. And then, what a particular person means when they say melee becomes very murky. So that's part of the thing that I've seen in these conversations that I get tangled up on with other people, frankly, which is interesting. So... Yeah, and even here, there was like things of like, well, did the fighter have to, run across the room before they got there? Well, the wizard could have cast a spell while that was happening. I'm like, oh, help me out here, people. So let's move past that. Let's move that and let's think about like you talking about BX. Because I think that BX falls in this category of early editions that has a very clear and stark rule. And maybe I'm overlooking something in BX. But for most of the early editions, And I have that on the second frame there. The rule is, like this question right here, the answer is absolutely prohibited. Just can't start. Can't even begin. If you're in combat.
I like that you've got it. We've got a nice image here of four different editions with highlight on the specific text. So I'm just going to read them out if that's all right. So we start here with chainmail. I've set myself up for failure because now I'm squinting at my screen. Let me get this in a slightly bigger window so my old man eyes can work properly here. Okay. Nope, it's that one. So in chainmail it says, in order to cast and maintain any spell, a wizard must be both stationary and, here's the highlighted part, undisturbed by attack upon his person. Okay, undisturbed by attack on his person. Somebody's actively attacking you, it's going to screw you up. Sword of Spell says, similarly, a spell, even from a device, cannot be cast if the spellcaster is engaged in melee. So here we get into your, like, what is melee, what qualifies, mm-hmm. but okay, if I'm engaged in melee, I can't cast a spell. Holmes Basic tells us, he can certainly not cast a spell while engaged in combat. Okay, I like that. It's a little more vague, but it's still using at least the word engaged, right? Now there's a little bit of maybe interpretation here of like, well, if I'm in the combat, like how do they have to be actively swinging a sword at me, right? Et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Okay, Vol ABX. Spells cannot be cast while performing any other action, in parentheses, such as walking or fighting.
Yeah.
What is fighting? Am I holding a sword and swinging it? Is it talking about that kind of fighting? Am I punching someone? Am I just standing near someone who might punch me? What constitutes fighting? And if you try to say, well, any fighting, right? Like, if you're in combat, not going to happen. Well, then I'm immediately going to jump to the combat sequence and say, like, well, then why is magic spells called out in the combat sequence?
Right.
If magic spells exist in the combat sequence, then clearly magic spells can be cast during combat. So when is it allowed and when is it not allowed in Mold ABX?
Right.
Unclear.
Right.
And depends on your definition of what fighting means.
Totally. Totally. I totally agree with it. And it's funny, I don't know if, like, is he intentionally trying to say something different than what Holmes said? Is he intentionally trying to change that rule? Is he just accidentally using a word that feels like a synonym? And it's funny that all of us keep trying to find the right language to clarify this and never manage to completely nail it down with a particular magic word about what we mean.
Let me walk back here and let me read the full paragraph here in Mold ABX, or at least the couple sentences that come before it. It says, a character who cannot talk or use hand motions for any reason, such as being bound or gagged, cannot use a spell. Similarly, because the words and gestures must be repeated exactly, spells cannot be cast while performing any other action, such as walking or fighting. And I find that interesting because he's calling out specifically, you've got hand motions and you got to talk, right? Mm-hmm. These are the qualifiers. Got to make hand motions, got to talk. So when I look at the combat sequence, I feel like arguments could be made about what of these things can I do all at once? So for example, missile fire and melee and hand-to-hand combat are called out as separate things. So can I do both, Dan? Can I both shoot my bow and swing my sword in one round? And I feel like it feels pretty obvious to me that the answer is no, because I don't have enough hands to do that, right? I would have to have my bow and arrow out as well as my sword. Yeah. Now I have to own three arms.
Yeah.
That's not going to work. And I suspect Mulvey is getting at the same thing here. I can't be having my sword out and my, you know, and be casting a spell. Actually, this is a point that I disagree on in my own interpretation. I usually say, like, you can one hand. Yeah. One hand is sufficient to cast a spell. You can hold your sword. That's fine. But you can't be, like, waving at it, swinging it, trying to kill someone, trying to stab someone while also casting a spell at the same time.
I say the same. I rule the same way as that myself. Yep.
So is that what Mulvey's getting at? Is Mulvey saying, like, your hands got to be free. Can't be swinging swords and shooting bows and casting a spell all in one round. You got to pick one of these three things during your round. Missile fire, magic spell, melee. They are mutually exclusive.
That's interesting. There is a paragraph under how to attack on the next page that says, is it worthwhile reading these things this closely? I don't know. And it says, in combat, attacks may be made with spells, magic attack, comma, weapons which are shot or thrown, missile fire, comma, or weapons which are held and swung, hand-to-hand or melee combat. Is that a strictly exclusive or? Is that paragraph the thing that says you got to pick one of these three modes of attack?
It's certainly always the way I've interpreted it, right? I wouldn't allow a character, sure, for example, to shoot their bow and arrow and then smack someone next to them with their bow while it's still in their hand, right? One could argue, I should be able to do that. I should be able to throw a rock and punch someone in one round. And like, no, you got to pick one. Throw the rock or punch.
Yeah.
Not both.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Agreed.
So
now
so
I'll say that, you know, part of the conversation. Go ahead.
However, I love seeing it all in one page here as you have it displayed and highlighted, so you can kind of see how it has morphed over time. It's kind of, they all feel like the same sentences, right? The same section of the rules, yeah, right? They're clarifying, yeah, changing wording, whatnot, right? And we got here from, you know, has to be undisturbed by attacks on your person. That's not talking about hands-free at all, right? In chainmail, it says attacks on my person.
Yes.
Are enough to disrupt my ability, yeah, to cast spells, right? And then Swords and Wizardry, yeah, says I can't be engaged in melee. What does engaged in melee mean? And generally for me, it means exactly what you outlined at the beginning. A fighter standing 5 feet from me, he's got a sword, he's trying to do violence on me. I'm engaged in melee, even if I'm going, oh God, not in the face, not in the face. I am still engaged
agreed,
in melee.
Agreed, agreed.
I agree. Yep. A Holmes changes it to be while engaged in combat, okay, kind of the same thing. Right, but
right,
maybe he's saying, like, I don't know, if that fighter is standing 5 feet from me and he's got his bow drawn and the arrow pointed at my face, that also counts.
Right?
Maybe.
Right? It's also interesting, like, how just, once again, how short the chain, like, that chainmail, you get that one sentence, it's almost one line. And then, and of course, I've cut out kind of paragraphs before and after in the later rules as they try to add more language and attempting to clarify these kinds of details and still leave question marks. You know, one part of the conversation on our Discord server was that the if you use a phased combat round, and hypothetically, let's say that you ignore these highlighted rules about prohibiting spellcasting in melee combat. Let's say you just ignore that. Then the phased, as you're kind of picking on, Paul, the phased round structure starts to answer some of these questions about disrupting spells in a different way. And so, like assuming that actions start at the beginning of the round, here in BX, the round is basically movement, then missiles, then spells, then melee. So you could read that as you could have your spell interrupted by an arrow shot, okay, which happens before your spells, then your spells happen, but it can't be interrupted by hand-to-hand attacks because that comes in a later phase. On the other hand, I think it was our friend Gamma Dan. Yes.
I have a counterpoint.
What do you think?
Counterpoint.
About? Yeah. Yeah, yeah, go
that,
ahead.
That entire sequence is per user, is per person. That somebody else's missile fire is not coming before my magic because it says the side with the next highest initiative acts second and so on using the order given above.
Okay, take it back.
Yep, no, right. No right. Enemy is doing that in that. Yeah.
Duly but stipulated.
Certainly some,
duly stipulated.
Some people have argued for like, yeah, well, what if we ignore that and we just say all missile fire and then all magic and then all melee? And that certainly changes things.
And then interestingly, our friend Gamma Dan pointed out that in the prior Holmes basic, and I will confess I can't find where it is this morning, in the prior Holmes basic, it has a different phase structure, which is movement and then spells and then missiles and then melee, so that, again, if you went for everybody, you could definitely get your spells off before the missiles and the melee happen, which would be different. And then, of course, if you go back to chainmail and you look at the initiative sequence, it doesn't know about spells when the initiative rules were written, and right, that's why right, all these different editions fill it in a different slot.
Interesting. Yep. Yep, that's right. Because, of course, in chainmail, there is no magic until you add the fantasy supplement. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Right. Isn't that fascinating? And you know what? Well, I'll leave that to later. You want to go to advanced D&D?
Sure, I'm sure that's going to be more clear and easier to follow. Let's look at that. Sorry, my opinion's coming out in my tone. Yes.
So it seems like with Gary, and here we are looking at Gary Gygax, what we call first edition, advanced D&D, wanted to make things a little more generous. And the rule in AD&D is not that you're just absolutely prohibited, but that you have to pre-declare specifically spells, not every action, but specifically you got to pre-declare your spells at the start of the round. And basically, if you then lose initiative and get hit before your part of the round comes around, then you lose the spell. So roughly 50-50, not totally prohibited. And I have a section here under casting spells in combat. It's got a numbered 5-point list. Number one, which I've got highlighted, says spellcasters must note what spell they intend to cast at the beginning of each round prior to any knowledge of which side has initiative. And then basically steps 2, 3, 4 are you're going to roll initiative more or less. And then the final step 5 is any successful attack or non-saved against attack upon the spellcaster interrupts the spell if it comes before their side's initiative. So so basically 50-50 that you're going to get it off more or less based on that initiative roll.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing to me about AD&D that's missing from this chunk of text here is I do feel like, as we saw in the earlier editions, they kind of tried to hook into this concept of what are the requirements for casting the spell? I need to be able to talk. I need to be able to move my hands, right? And then AD&D made it far more complicated by introducing the concepts of verbal, somatic, and material components. So now it depends on the spell. Now, right, some spells need me to move my hands, and some don't. And some have words, and some don't. And some need an object, and some don't. And there are some spells that just need one or all three or whatever. And so now per spell, I got to know, like, can I cast this spell while bound and gagged or not?
I often think of, in my kind of amateur experience with 5th edition D&D, I usually think of 5th edition D&D as somewhat simpler as having clarified or cleaned up some of these rules. And we're going to put a pin in this for a couple minutes, but I was wildly surprised that the issues that you just talked about, Paul, are actually in some sense worse in the current 5th edition, which I was very surprised to find out about.
Disregarding that, because ultimately the counter argument to that is like, well, most spells turns out need at least verbal and somatic, if not verbal, somatic, and material. So like most spells need all of them. So that's moot. But interesting here that it's leaning on the you've got to pre-declare action, right? And this was part of our initiative conversation from yesterday of like, do you require pre-declaring actions or not? And that is wildly debated, right? Like. Do you even do that? Has anybody ever done that? Okay. I don't want to.
I gotta say that our patrons. Okay, so it's very interesting the conversations because many of our viewers and many of our patrons, Paul, are very pro pre-declaring actions and phased round structures. And you and I personally don't do that, and we're actually kind of outliers in our own community. From what I can tell. So it's really interesting to see the experiences of our patrons shared on Discord because in my own practice, I'm actually a little bit surprised, but people are very happy with how that works in their games. And I keep having to reflect upon that because they have very fairly different experiences than I've had. Now, again, this might have something to do with me occasionally running huge tables. Sometimes I have run 10, 12, 14, 15 person tables. And like I said last week, some of those rules that I wanted to use got expunged at the moment when I realized that it was a huge problem for larger groups. And if people aren't dealing with groups as large as that, that might be the telling difference in their experiences, maybe.
It is an input for sure. But like personally, I will say it's rare that I run for such large groups. I've run for larger groups, but generally nothing that big. I usually try to cap my games at 8, and I would say more often than not it's 6 people. Mm-hmm. But that said, I also definitely am a person who favors simplicity. And if any rule is going to slow down the pacing of my game, I'm pretty quick to axe it. And that's, you know, pre-declaring actions and complicated initiative systems, they're real fast on the list, right? As we just discussed in the initiative discussion, I like group initiative fixed during the combat, so it's rolled once up front. We just go around the table, and we literally go around the table. I'm just going to look in a circle, and each person goes in the order that they are sitting. And that actually kind of precludes any ability to ever interrupt a spell.
Which was the question that came, was the first critical question on Discord that came up was exactly, was someone could clearly deduce that that had to be the case based on what we said last week. Yeah.
Right. Now I can have the follow-up discussion if you want of, is that a bad thing? And have thoughts on that one. But I will not, deny that my preferred initiative system precludes it from even being a possible.
That's what I wanted to, I personally wanted to ask you that myself, because I was actually slightly unclear. I couldn't remember if that had ever come up with me playing in your game. So I actually, a very large reason of why I wanted this for the topic today was so that I could ask you that exact question. So thank you.
There you go. Asked and answered.
Let me throw up a piece of chat just as an example of the other side of this. So in our chat here, John Thomas Kaiser is saying that pre-declaring is what I've done for 35 years in second edition. It works like it's supposed to with initiative and disrupting spells. And I think that's a good reminder that basically second edition advanced D&D more or less have pretty much the same rule as first edition advanced D&D. Pre-declaring specifically the spells, having the initiative roll then determine whether it gets disrupted. And then I will say that second edition added as an option the first time that they suggested maybe you could roll initiative for each individual character separately. And if that's the case, you're going to roll a D10. You're going to use the casting time as a modifier on that. And I think that's also the first time that they say, if you get hit before your turn comes up, then your spell fizzles. And certainly, I think a lot that became part of the lexicon starting with second edition there. So basically, John's basically doing this more pretty close to the same thing you'd see in first edition. Now, in third edition, you get third edition. And again, another step on kind of being a little bit more generous. So third edition is where you first use the word attacks of opportunity for dangerous stuff when you're standing next to a fighter who has a sword and is alert and aware and wants to do violent damage to you. And so the rule specifically for spells here is, I'll read the highlight here. Generally, if you cast a spell, you provoke attacks of opportunity from threatening enemies. If you take damage from attack of opportunity, then you must make a concentration check with the target level being 10 plus the points of damage taken, plus the spell level, or you lose the spell. So here, cast a spell next to somebody dangerous, they get a chance to hit you, and then even if they hit you, there's another safety net behind that of if you can make the saving throw, you can still get your spell off, even having been hit, which is certainly more generous. Yep. And the other thing I'll say is that third edition is the first time that let you move and cast a spell. All the prior stuff said generally in the same place said you can't move and you can't be in combat. And now third edition is nice enough that you can move, you can cast a spell, maybe even get hit and still get it off. So that's a whole different thing.
Yeah. I don't know. We've probably wasted countless hours of debate on the concept of attacks of opportunity, which I'm sure, I can say that both we meaning you and we meaning the collective D&D playing world, definitely one of the more hotly contested and debated rules in the game. I don't think you have a fifth edition text block here, because that went away, right? Attacks of opportunity?
Okay. You want to talk about fifth edition, sir? Okay. Fifth edition.
Yeah, I do.
I'll briefly say that third edition, right, is going to have these additional complications. Like, do you like skill systems? Mm-hmm. Because when it says concentration check, concentration is a skill that can be purchased and leveled up by your wizardy type characters. So then you get how many skill points do I want to put into the skill that lets me do that? And there are feats that modify that. There's combat casting, which helps me out. There's feats on the feats and abilities on the other side that make it more likely you're going to disrupt spells. And you get the whole skill feat metagame but how much do you want to pump into making that a possibility? So the thing that I, and the reason why I don't have a fifth edition block here, and the thing that I learned this weekend is that there's no, to my understanding, there's no specific place in fifth edition that has a rule about casting spells in combat. Rather, you have to follow a chain of rule implications to figure out what happens. And here, to my understanding, here is the following chain of logical rule implications in fifth edition. Item one, manipulation actions trigger an attack of opportunity. Okay, so there's a sub-action type called manipulating a thing, and that causes an attack of opportunity. Now, among the examples of manipulation actions are any spell with a nonverbal component. So if you have a somatic component or a material component, or I guess doing concentration, I think, then that causes a manipulation action and that causes an attack of opportunity. If you have a purely verbal spell, then you dodge that. Purely verbal spell doesn't cause an attack of opportunity. Now, second bullet point, an attack of opportunity, if you hit the person whose action, right, which might be a manipulation type action, if you hit someone doing the action, you generally, you can disrupt that action, but only on a critical. Only on a critical hit do you disrupt that action. So the vast majority of the time, if you're standing next to an opposing fighter, you can cast a spell, they get an attack of opportunity. Even if they hit you, the spell still automatically goes off as long as you're just not dead and they didn't roll a 20. So almost all the time in 5th edition, you can get it off for free, even if you trigger an attack of opportunity, even if you get hit. You pretty much always get it off. And that was, I thought that was a fascinating, unexpected rule in 5th edition when I discovered that.
That is very interesting. Yep. Of course, there's a lot more character types casting what effectively constitutes spells, right? The definition of what even is a spell is wider, right? And I'm thinking specifically of things here like, I don't know, bards who are maybe cursing their enemies, right? I don't remember the names of the spells, right? But there's that kind of stuff. I guess not terribly surprised that it's blown even wider open in 5th edition. Wow, it's gotten complicated, man. It's gotten real complicated.
Going to answer Julian's good question there. And I think Julian plays more 5th edition than I do. My understanding is this is, I just described the 2014 rule, and 2024 didn't change anything about it.
Cool.
Is my understanding. But it's interesting that the arc has gone from chainmail and the next couple editions after chainmail saying absolutely prohibited, cannot cast spells in combat in any way, through somewhat more generous, and now fifth edition 2014, basically you can always cast spells in combat practically no matter what happens. So a very interesting switch from one side to the other over the years.
I will give now my argument around, like, is that a bad thing? If that's all right, if you're ready to engage in that conversation, Dan.
Yes, please.
I think it's fine. I don't need spell interruption in my games, and I don't mind it being easier for magic users to get their spells off. And I'll give you some reasons. And most of my reasons are rooted in early edition. Like, my brain is pretty thoroughly fixed in BX, D&D, but that's what I'm talking about, is like early stuff. Your wizards don't get a lot of spells. Unless you're playing very high level, there simply aren't that many that they're going to get to play with. They suck at pretty much everything else. So I don't mind allowing them, you know, to pretty universally do the one thing they're actually good at a little more easily.
I think that's a strong argument. Particularly the relatively small number of spells, too. I will say that I played the same for quite a number of years, largely because of that gap in original D&D, just not saying anything about it. And then, you know, I read a little bit more widely and I realized that all those early editions were consistent. And for me, a lot of the time, if I'm trying to fill in a gap, if the edition right before it said a thing and the edition right after it said the same thing, then I feel pretty confident in interpolating that Gary intended that rule to be consistent. So if I see it in Chainmail and I see it in Swords and Spells, which is the original D&D War supplement, I'm guessing that he probably intended that consistently all the way throughout, and that both of those things clearly said cannot cast, cannot move, cannot cast in combat, period, end of story. So I felt like I felt uncomfortable then saying that I'm playing original D&D and not honoring that rule. And maybe about 2 years ago, I was like, okay, that's the original D&D rule. That's what we see in Chainmail, so that must hold. And I started doing that in my games. And for example, like my Wizards Warzone playtest sessions. And then I wasn't happy with it. And among the problems that I had was like, okay, so now like you're in, like, what if you do have a lot of spells? You're an archmage and a goblin runs up next to you. You're totally helpless. You're just flat out totally helpless. If any enemy at all just gets 5 feet from you, you're entirely locked down. That didn't quite feel right. You know, and previously I was saying, you know, wizards are dangerous. They're powerful. You want to shoot the sheriff, you better get him on the first shot because it's going to be trouble for you. I didn't frankly mind wizards being dangerous. And the other thing is in my Wizards Warzone sessions, I would, more than once have, they're all wizards. So Wizard A gets up next to Wizard B and they're both canceled. Right. And then all of a sudden, like I have these archmages, right? And they just happen to get in contact. Like, well, now it's a slap fight. Now they're just slapping each other in the face or trying to stab each other with a small knife because that's actually the only thing that they can do. And I'm like, that's not the flavor that I wanted. And I wasn't happy with that.
It's funny. I like the visual of it, but yeah. I mean, interestingly, I think a big thing that's affecting this here is another rule that kind of vanished over the time, which was that you can't move and cast a spell, right? And I use that, and I know you use that, and it's pretty consistent in the early editions of the game. But definitely, I would say it's something that, frankly, catches most players by surprise these days when I tell them about it, right? When they're like, oh, it's my turn. I'm going to walk through the door and cast the spell. And I'm like, you can't. You got to pick one.
And even in advanced D&D, right? He actually lays out a whole, Gary lays out a whole very specific scenario of like, there's monsters on the other side of the door. Like maybe you can have a fighter pop open the door and cast a spell through the door just as it opens up. Maybe you can get that accomplished, but you definitely can't charge through the door and cast a spell. And it's something that with my players, if I sit down with new players, I have a note that I have to highlight that difference in older rules because just like you said there, Paul, people are confused the first time they run into that.
Yeah. It's definitely something that catches folks by surprise, right? For all the complexity that later editions have added, right, around components and attacks of opportunity and et cetera, I feel like this is one where they said, let's get rid of that, right? You can move and attack. That's their move and cast spell, no problem.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. Yeah. Now, the one thing that I do rule that I don't know where this came from, and I'm struggling now to draw this from some real hard rule other than just simply I may have fallen into this accidentally and discovered I enjoy it, is I do allow movement and use of a magic item such as a wand. And is the kind of the rule breaker that is real nice, and it makes wands kind of extra cool. That I can run through the door and blast with my wand, and that works. Where do we stand on that, Dan? Do you have any background on is that a rule somewhere that I pulled from an edition of the game, or is that nonsense?
First edition is very clear about being more generous with devices. And it's very clear about that's much safer to use in a combat situation. Hey, wizards, you should get devices like a wand because they're easier to use in combat. So at least the sense of that is absolutely delivered in first edition. I was very surprised fairly recently when I was pursuing this to see that in Swords and Spells, and we had it on screen before, Swords and Spells, it's very explicit that that doesn't help you at all. It very much says, including devices like rings or wands, you can't move with those and you can't use those in combat either. And I was actually quite surprised because of how different it is from the first edition rule that I was more familiar with. It's an interesting point.
Is it even mentioned in something like EX or original edition prior to Swords and Spells?
Not original edition. Magic items didn't even exist in chainmail, more or less, for spellcasting. I don't know about BX. Maybe yes, maybe no.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if it's simply not mentioned, right? Which is probably why I had to, you know, improvise it. Maybe it's there. I don't know. Research for the future. That's interesting. I like it. I like the flavor it adds. Usually I implement that, especially like things like wands and staves that just produce a spell-like effect. I usually cap those at the minimum level. So like, yeah, a wand of magic missile, it's shooting less magic missiles or weaker magic missiles or less or weaker fireballs than you could if you just cast them. But
yes,
easier to execute. And that's a nice trade-off. I like that trade-off.
I agree. I don't mind it at all. Now, there are viewer requests, Paul, on the table for two things before the before we wrap up our show. And one is the original question on Discord of like, what do I, Dan, personally do? Which you notice I haven't said yet. and two is, what about counterspelling? And we should touch on both of those. So the interesting thing, one thing that the only place that has any clue about this issue in the original D&D books, and I'm going to try to get it on camera here, my physical book, is when it describes what the dexterity ability is for, right? There's all the text about what dexterity is for in original D&D there, and the last couple of words says that it's used for determining actions such as getting off a spell. Dexterity for getting off a spell. Now, none of these rules that we've discussed ever connect with dexterity. None of them. Not the early ones, not the initiative system in advanced D&D. The concentration skill in third edition is not dexterity based. It's based on constitution. Fifth edition doesn't have anything to do with it. So there's these literally four words, getting off a spell, that actually is an original D&D, which doesn't have any other detail to it anywhere. So trying to honor the original rules as close as I can, so that, you know, when I say original D&D, I'm just being honest, frankly. What I started to do a year ago was, if a wizard's in that situation, I just have him make a dexterity check. I just have him make a flat dexterity, just roll a d20 under your dexterity. Success, you get the spell off. Fail, you lose the spell. Some of my players were surprised about a year ago when I started testing that out. Sometimes you get it very simple. It's not a whole lot of rules. It's not skill versus feat something. It doesn't require pre-declaration. It doesn't require phased combat. Currently, that's what I'm doing. So I put that forth to the committee, you and others, Paul. How do you feel about that?
But wait, I guess what I'm missing, Dan, is what is the window for which that's necessary? Assuming that you use the same initiative system I use of group roles, go around the table, when is there ever an opportunity for a spell to get disrupted?
The wizard is standing 5 feet away from an opposing fighter who is alert and aware, has a sword, and wants to do violence as fast and efficiently as possible to the wizard. So if you're in that, you know, in what you'd call a threatened zone, and you want to get a spell off, you got to make a dexterity check now.
Gosh, so you're using it literally as a way of qualifying or breaking that scenario of can a wizard even cast a spell while in melee combat? Interesting.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've just universally allowed that in my games. Like, I'm just no check required. It just happens. Well, yes, absolutely.
Like I did up to 2 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
You used to do the same. This is
interesting. Interesting. So you force them in the specific case of. Yeah.
Melee hand with
that. My main concern with that is the weird edge cases of what about this weird use case? Technically, I'm not directly next to this creature. I don't feel like I'm in melee combat, but maybe they have super long tentacles that can reach anywhere in the scene, or I don't know, something, right? Like, there are weird cases where I think it will maybe possibly become gray situationally about whether or not it counts. And I just don't want to have
good
those
point.
Discussions. I would just rather lop those off than need to not do them. Using dexterity, do I care about, like, it's a dexterity check? I don't know. Yeah, I guess it's clever. It's fine. I don't hate having to make a dexterity check. But I would say it's a complication I don't want or need.
Got it. Interesting. And anybody in the, chat or our Discord server, I'd like to, get other questions. I haven't had the giant tentacles issue come up yet, so that hasn't confronted me yet.
Not enough giant tentacles there's some other, in your game then, Dan. That's what I'm hearing. More giant tentacles.
Okay, say that to my Star Frontiers players, because they are absolutely sick to death of everything having tentacles everywhere they go. And now they're actually becoming surprised if they aren't being attacked by tentacles. So that got shifted to my Star Frontiers game, more or less.
That's great.
And the other thing we should address that people want to talk about is counter spells. Is someone casting a spell and a non-opposing wizard being able to do something magical at that moment to counter their energy? And, it's interesting because it's something that in a lot of editions is vague or kind of suggested. What does it say in like in chainmail, you have to make a die roll to get your spell off, and it says the stronger magician can successfully cast a counter spell with a 2-dice score of 7 or better, and then different numbers for weaker magic users, basically. That's not a rule that technically appears in original D&D or Swords and Spells or Advanced D&D 1st or 2nd Edition. 3rd Edition had a very big complicated system, kind of looked at that language, I think, and had a complicated system of you could react on the fly and cast the spell. You could cast, I think, the same spell. You could cast, like, if he's got fire and I've got ice, I could cast that at the moment to cancel their spell and have no effect on either side. And I know that some of our patrons have been working on their own counterspell house rules. Do you use a counterspell type rule like from 3rd Edition, Paul?
I have to say, I am surprised to learn that there's any reference to it in earlier editions at all. I always assumed counterspell was a later edition invention. Yep. And that it didn't actually show up in the 3rd Edition. Do I use them? No, not at all. Absolutely not. Yep. It is a complication, again, that I just don't need. I will always favor snappy, fast pacing over all other concerns. Don't need it. Don't want it. There's no counterspell in my games.
And I don't like,
and, like the weird window.
If I've had stuff where player A says I do this, and then it's important that player B say, "Oh boy, before that happens, I do this." Those kind of interrupty things, I've mostly expunged.
I appreciate that you interrupted what I was saying to tell me that. yeah.
Oh my god.
I will say. The one argument I've seen for it in older editions is often with dispel magic, right? Can I use dispel magic in the moment as I see the enemy? I'm watching the enemy wizard. I'm waiting for him to do something terrible. I've got dispel magic at the ready. Can I please just prepare to dispel whatever's coming out of his mouth? And my general ruling on that is no, you can't. If I read the text of dispel magic, at least from, say, BX edition, it tells me that it cancels magical effects that are in place. It does not cancel magical effects as they are emerging. So you can use your dispel magic after the fact to stop doing whatever happened, but you're not going to say, for example, diffuse a fireball before it explodes.
Yeah. I think that I'm trying to pull up the first edition dispel magic. My feeling is that because chainmail doesn't have a dispel magic spell. It has this one place where it uses the word counter spell. And I think that was used as inspiration for these other, well, what does that mean systems? But my personal reading is that it is the dispel magic spell in D&D that fills in that capacity. And generally there's nothing in the early editions that let you cast a spell on the fly out of the normal turn sequence. So the first edition spell says, what does dispel magic do? It says it will destroy magic potions. Okay, thank you. It will remove spells cast on persons or objects, or counter the casting of spells in the area of effect. So I guess that opens a window for what does that last third thing mean? Is that interrupting ability? Can you do it on the fly while somebody else casts? The Q1 adventure that has Lolth in it, Queen of the Demon Web Pits, okay, spoiler everybody, has a particular location that's trapped that says, here is a dispel magic that's been made permanent by Lolth. And so if you happen to be standing in that zone while you're casting, your spell gets spoiled as a result. Was that an extrapolation?
Like anti-magic shell? Like that's, you know.
It's weird. It's called the spell magic specifically, question mark.
That's weird.
Did Gary let that happen on the fly? It seems very, very unclear. I don't know
it's,
if
it's our, a, what a weird thing, though. Why not just call it? Because anti-magic shells have existed forever, right? Like, why not just call it make it a permanent spell magic rather than an anti-magic shell?
Yep.
That's odd.
Right. Right.
I will say, though, there's one case of, like, very fiddly interruption or mucking with spells on the fly that I honestly I've not gotten to play with, and I keep trying to, which is the item Ring of Spell Turning. I keep chucking these into my games, and somehow players never pick them up or never find them. They never come up. Yeah. And I'm like, I want to see it in effect because I know it's going to make my brain squirm. Some player's going to have it on for some really inconvenient spell because, of course, it turns part of the spell and you like have to roll for the percentage of the spell that goes back at the caster. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of spells where that just doesn't make any sense at all. And I'm actually tickled by the idea of having to adjudicate that. So I keep trying to put myself in a situation where I do, and it just doesn't seem to come up.
Good. Great attitude. Great attitude. I love that.
Get myself in that uncomfortable position. You ever had to deal with a spell, a Ring of Spell?
I have a pre-generated character. I have one, maybe two pre-generated characters that have Rings of Spell Turning. And unfortunately, I feel that probably more than once, it doesn't turn area effects. So if the party gets a fireball dropped on them, that doesn't have anything to do with it. It only affects things that are directly targeted at the ring wearer. So they just happen to have to be the target of a charm person or feeble mind or whole person or something like that for it to come up. And plus, as DM, I don't remember that. So the player has to know, again, right? It becomes one of these interrupty things where they have to say, wait, I have a Spingarel spell turning. And I think that we've overlooked it a couple times. So the action, it very rarely, if ever, actually has an effect in the games because of those two separate things.
Yeah.
So I've had my games and they still don't come up even for me, Paul.
That's hilarious. Dan, we are out of time. Do you have any final thoughts on spell disruption?
I'm still up in the air on this. I have, this is a place where I can't be dogmatic about this because I feel like I'm still testing my rules out today about what I and my players are happy with. I, up until fairly recently, I did the exact same thing as you, Paul. It's like, I want the wizards to be powerful and dangerous. They can always cast, which ironically is basically the fifth edition rule as I understand it now. And then I tried to get closer to the intention of original D&D. Now I've got these dexterity checks that kick in if you're immediately next to an enemy. No one's come to me and said that, none of my players have come and said they hate it. So I'm still, it seems like it's a benefit to my Wizard Warzone games where everybody's a wizard in competition. So that's what I'm currently playing with. It's a little unusual. I guess I'm personally still figuring that out. So if our viewers have comments either in the chat on YouTube or the comments on YouTube or our Discord server, I would want to hear about that, whether they think that's a good idea or I'm overlooking some obvious problem.
Yep. All right. Yeah, for me, it's just too fiddly. It's too fiddly to bother with, and I will chalk it right up there with weapon speeds and segments. Just not for me. No thanks. Not going to bother with
it. Okay. You're comfortable clearly being off book from Moldvay BX, are you?
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah. Certainly in the. I'm at least off from Moldvay BX in the whole. Can you cast while fighting? I guess I would say I interpret the "you cannot cast a spell while fighting" to mean you can't both swing your sword and cast a spell in the same turn. That's my interpretation of that writing.
Great. Clever. Love it.
Successfully dodged. Viewers, if you have an opinion on spell disruption, if you have a different system than something that we've talked about, or you've seen it in play, or you've seen problems with it in play that we haven't mentioned, please leave a comment for us here in the YouTube video. We would love to hear from you. Maybe it is something, especially for Dan, to continue to chew on, something that we will possibly return to in the future.
Definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We are on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub. We have the handle Wandering DMs, so please look for us on all those sites. And please rattle that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are on our website at wanderingdms.com. They're also available through various podcast distributors like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those other sites and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, like we've been saying, thanks to our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Every tier gets you access to our Discord server where the conversation's continuing round the clock and feeds back into our episodes every week. So we would love to see you there, including our live video after chat that will be on in about 10 minutes to continue the conversation, get some more of your feedback directly that we didn't work into the show here. So if you're not already a patron, $1 will get you there. We would love to see you there in our after chat in about 10 minutes after the hour here. And we're all there, right, Paul? You, me, we're all there. Yep. Today.
Yep, absolutely.
Fantastic.
Looking forward to it.
Fantastic. I feel like there's going to be possibly some spicy takes there, which I am looking forward to myself. So don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion. We'll see.